the debt ceiling agreement was voted on by the House yesterday. And what happened? Well, it overwhelmingly passed, which, Abby, I don't know if you can, maybe you can help me here. What talk show host predicted that it was going to pass and pass big?
I think it was you.
There you go. Let's get that over with right away. Anyway, 300 and some votes for. I mean, it just, you know, it's going to go to the Senate. It's going to pass that big there. So we asked someone that we know understands the budgeting process and the economics that come with it. Riaz Aziz is an instructor of economics at Concordia College. And Riaz is somebody we've called in before to talk economics, to talk about issues like this. And good to have you back on News and Views.
Joel, happy to be here. Good morning.
Now, let's get to the details first, and then we can whine about the process. Okay?
Fair enough? You bet.
When you read it, when you looked at it, what did you see in terms of the product in the end versus what was even being debated?
Okay, I'll tell you one thing. The big C. We want to talk. Nobody wants to talk about that in Congress, but this was how the founding fathers meant Congress to act. You have to have a compromise. There's a whole bunch of winners and there's a whole bunch of losers at the end of the day, depending upon your perspective. Okay, the vets are going to be looking good on this in this budget, at least the way it's been passed at the House at this level right now. Their budget remains intact. The unspent COVID money, which should have been pulled back anyway, that got pulled back. The good news over there is that $5 billion was left on the table for future vaccination development, if you will, to be able to do a rapid response there. The IRS funding, I'm a little bit not certain how that's going to work. $1.4 billion is what the reduction is in the IRS bill, the IRS funding, if you will, which kind of seems, I'm not sure, intuitive, because when you think about it, Congress says the reason we are having a deficit right now is we're spending more than we're taking in, and people who are supposed to be paying their fair share are not doing so. That's why we have the IRS agents. So on one hand, you have them there to be able to check on it. On the other hand, we are claiming that we have too much money on the IRS table. So overall, the foster care program certainly was positive. I have to be upfront with you, let you know this is a 99-page bill. I haven't had a chance to look at it in dissected, if you will. But in the broader sense, if you will, the Democrats get to stand up and say, hey, listen, we managed to keep the country from going into a catastrophe. The Republicans managed to stand up and say, we managed to keep control over how much government is spending. So both sides get to go home after this is done, able to tell the constituents we got something out of it.
So explain to people what would happen to the American economy if we had basically said we're not paying our bills, well, if we hadn't increased the debt ceiling.
Well, it's the same thing happens if you and I decide tomorrow, let's say you go home to your spouse and I go to my mind's. We're not going to pay for the mortgage. We're not going to pay for the car we bought. We're not going to pay for the trip that we took. We're not going to pay for the credit card. What's going to happen if all Americans did that? That is exactly, this is the only country in the developed country in the world that spends the money, allocates the budget for it, and then decides whether or not you should make the payment. It's backwards. As an economist.
Wait. Just repeat that again, because those three steps, because I think it's important people realize that chronologically, you're getting it right.
Yes, and that's the problem. The problem is we go ahead and allocate the funds. We agree that we're going to spend money on all of these things, but then we're trying to have a debate as to whether or not we should make the payment. Yeah. So you're living in the house and you're trying to discuss whether or not you should make the mortgage payment. That's a little bit too late. Frankly speaking, as an economist, I will tell you this, Joel, we should never, ever have a conversation about the debt ceiling. We should have a conversation about whether or not we should be spending money in the first place.
A budget.
Exactly.
A budget.
Exactly.
You should have a budget. And that budget says, look, Mr. President, Congress passed this. Even if you vetoed it, we have enough votes to override you. These are the rules.
Exactly.
You as the executive branch have to live by these rules. Instead, it's a political ploy.
Yep.
The debt ceiling is a political ploy so that they can come out. And if I were the Republicans in this deal, what I would be the most mad about is 2024 is an election year, right? If they're going to use the debt ceiling for political purposes, which we just did, then why did they say we're not going to look at it again until 2025?
Exactly. And that's because nobody wants to address this whole issue at that time, if you will, because, again, Congress's job is to get reelected, okay? Which is one of the reasons why we're having this conversation now about something so silly. To me, the debt ceiling conversation is like this. All right. Your plane's going down. Okay. Everybody knows this is going to crash. And your flight attendants are trying to figure out which coffee maker to make work so you can have your last cup. I mean, it makes no sense. Let the debt ceiling remain unlimited. Let Congress get together with the White House and all three two parties, the three branches, if you will, or two branches within the House of Congress, and say, this is what we're going to spend, this is what we're taking in, and this is our limit, and then stick to it. This generational thing, year after year, year after year, year after year, is detrimental. If we had gone in a default, Joel, it isn't just about the U.S. economy. Every time we cough, the rest of the world has a hiccup. Okay, this would have affected the European Union. This would have affected the Middle East. This would have affected Africa, South America, every place else. So we would have had a global catastrophe if the United States, not to mention our bond ratings. Now, in spite of all of this, the S&P, the Dow Jones have been actually doing pretty decent, if you will, in recent days. And that's because everybody now sees this as a political ploy. Congress takes us
They knew they weren't going to default.
Exactly.
They knew it.
Everybody knew the Congress was going to take us to the very edge and then say, well, to save the nation, we went ahead and voted on it.
I won't get into the weeds about the McCarthy of the world and the Bidens of the world. Just the sheer economics of the world. Had they defaulted, had they not done their job, as you just described, would have that led to instant recession?
I'm not saying it would have led to instant recession, but I'll tell you what we would have done. Your and my retirement would have taken a severe hit, number one. Number two, majority of the borrowing the United States does, Americans probably don't fully realize this, is borrowed money from foreigners, who are then going to look at the United States, which right now is the most reliable economy in the world, to say, if that economy doesn't want to pay its bills, why should we loan them, or at least loan them at the interest rate we're currently loaning them? So our interest rate goes up. It's just no different than if you and I were to declare bankruptcy and try to borrow money again. Okay, so the catastrophe would have been over and over again. So the deficit we've been talking about could conceivably have doubled, based upon if you add the higher interest rate, if you will, and the promises already made.
Stick around. Many more questions to come. Also, some overall numbers when we just take a look at deficits. I mean, we never look at deficits in regards to the time frame, that where we're at in that point. For example, I'll give you one before the break. If it's 2008, right, you're sitting there, and you've got a deep recession coming on, to the point where you've got a housing crisis, homes overvalued, all of this. Government went in and spent a bunch of money. They spent a bunch of money that they didn't have.
Exactly.
And what did it do?
Exactly.
It saved us.
Exactly.
But it added to the debt.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So stick around more with Riaz Aziz. He's an instructor of economics at Concordia College. He understands it. Riaz Aziz is our guest. He is an instructor of economics at Concordia College. Love getting a chance to talk to him about issues like the country is going through right now with its debt ceiling debate. And of course, we both agree. I mean, we disagree on so many things, Riaz, but one thing we both agree on is you should work from a budget. You should have a budget. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, the cause and effect, the push on where some of this goes. You know, right now, when you overall look at the economy, what you see is an economy, in my opinion, that is not headed towards recession if it had some of the tools that it needs. For example, I think it would explode if we had more workers, that we need more workers, and this economy is just sitting there like a time bomb waiting to go, whew, watch my business go now.
Exactly, Joe. Like I said during the break, I think this idea that we can work ourselves out of it through technology is a non-starter at this point. Technology only takes us so far. We have way too many vacancies in this country right now to make us as productive as we possibly can, especially in the high-end technology area, if you will, in sciences, if you will. And we need to find a way of fixing the immigration issues so that we can, again, deal with the fact that we just don't have enough workers.
But when you say that, here's where I get in trouble when I say that. When I say, look, we have to realize that that's a resource on our southern border, that these are workers that are going to do jobs that other people don't want to do. They show up every morning and they work hard. They maybe don't speak the language you speak. They maybe don't have the same culture you have. But the fact of the matter is they'll do the job that you want. And yet we, as an economy now, I'm not talking about political philosophy, but as an economy, can't access them.
Right.
And that drives me nuts.
Well, it's like telling somebody, like maybe I mentioned this example before, you come in and you've been diagnosed with cancer and you've been asked to go home and take a Tylenol. It doesn't work like that. Okay, chemotherapy and all the other stuff that we need to do to be able to help with this disease takes some time and it takes some process. But if you keep ignoring it, it's not going to go away. And that's exactly the situation we're faced with right now. We have people that are willing to work, but they can't work because we have a very rigid system in place. We don't have a system in place. For example, like Congress was having a conversation as part of this debt ceiling about whether or not to waive the student loan. Okay, mm-hmm. Whether you agree or disagree with that principle of philosophy, because you and I paid for a loan, we borrowed money, we paid for it. So the question is, why should we forgive somebody else? Okay. You want to talk about fairness? That's a different argument. The problem is this: when we have young people getting out of college with the amount of debt that they're having and struggling to be able to pay the debt as well as hold the jobs, if you will, we don't have a very, very thriving economy because of that. Okay. Now, again, I think. Certainly there's an argument to be made that that is not a fair approach, if you will. Why should somebody mm-hmm. be forgiven when you and I paid for us? I understand that argument. But at the end of the day, if I'm looking at the major economical issues, my thing is, let's put people to work. Let's get this economy going even greater so that we can see. Here's the thing, folks. China and India, both countries with huge population, with a workforce that is willing to work, a workforce that is being educated, if you will, I suspect that if we do not manage our immigration system in the United States and we don't manage our education system in the United States as well as those countries are doing, they might very well surpass us economically speaking. Okay, and that's because they are basically investing a huge amount in education and huge amount in training and allowing, if you will, their vacancies to be filled, whether it's from U.S. or Europe or other parts of the world.
Both of those countries, there's one I fear economically more than the other. And the one that I fear the most is India because of their policy. Okay, China quit having kids, mm-hmm. and that's an issue. That is a real issue. China, you know, told families you can have one. Mm-hmm. Okay. India, not so much. Their exactly. workforce is growing.
Exactly.
Their ability to be more productive on a higher scale of what they do, growing. I mean, they're a serious competitor to what's going to happen in our economy worldwide.
And in virtually every field, technology, sciences, if you will, and in finance, India is taking huge strides in those areas. And we are lagging behind at this point right now. Now, we have the ability to be the forefront leader in all of this. But if we start having this taste great, less filling debate constantly about immigration, all that's doing is it's stifling our growth. It's
and
not helping us.
And the debt ceiling. It's a ridiculous debate to
which
have.
Is why I told you in the beginning, as an economist, we should never have this conversation about the debt ceiling.
What about the role of women in the economy? Because if you look at India, for example, I don't believe they utilize women as part of their economy and economic power that they could, that we do, mm-hmm. quite frankly, mm-hmm. where we allow women to succeed in the workplace and realize that look, brighter, smarter, more dedicated, many things are brought to the table by women. What about India when it comes to that? What about China when it comes to that?
Well, India has come to realize in the last 10, maybe 20 years or so that 50% of the population is this untapped resource. So now in India, as you begin to go to just about any industry, it is still very highly male-dominated environment, but you are seeing women take so many roles in India right now that it's out of tradition. And that's the other big scary part. You know, you have
how's country, their religion dealing with that?
I'm sorry?
How is the religion? I mean,
well, religion doesn't, there is no religion in India that I'm aware of, whether it's the Hinduism, Muslimism, Sikhism, Jainism, if you will, that restricts women from working, from the workforce. It is basically tradition in terms of roles and responsibilities, motherhood, parent, wife, and so on and so forth. So those things are beginning to change. And even Indians are starting to realize, you know, having 5 and 6 kids isn't economically productive for us as well. So they're toning down their numbers, if you mm-hmm. will. But the population is so huge. As you know, this next year, they will surpass China, if you will, and be the nation with the highest population in the world, a bigger workforce.
When we come back, we'll get into some of the details of the budget. Well, I keep saying budget deal. debt ceiling deal. Riaz Aziz is our guest. He is an instructor of economics at Concordia College. We're talking about the debt ceiling. We're talking about inflation. We're talking about the recession. We're talking about a little bit of everything here. But overall, we're talking about the economy. Riaz, when you look at where we're at, and I'm going to ask you the question this way, okay? The city we're in is really no different than a lot of cities out there, you know, but we'll use Fargo as the first example. Everything that you could possibly use downtown, they've used. Whether it is TIF money, whether it is Renaissance Zone money, whether it is, you know what I'm getting at, mm-hmm. okay? So all of that stuff is based upon a very simple margin of an interest rate.
Exactly.
Very optimistic when mm-hmm. it comes to it, I might add. Mm-hmm. So then interest rates start climbing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have a fixed rate mm-hmm. the way you and I might have on our home.
Exactly.
Agreed?
Exactly.
How much danger is there out there? And I'm not trying to single out Fargo, because we could talk about Philadelphia, New York, and wherever. But how much danger is there out there? Out there is there in our economy right now?
I think that the danger is quite significant, because as the interest rates continue to grow, I was reading an article recently, especially on the East Coast, not so much about Fargo, but Fargo could be affected as well, that with every ounce of interest rate that goes up, businesses are anywhere within 6 months to a year of not being able to make their payments. And that's because, like you said, Joel, it is all connected to the interest rate. The interest rates are right now being driven by the Feds, which is being driven by our demand, if you will. And our ability to structure our business loans, if you will, is limited because again, if the economy is strong, a higher interest rate does okay. But if the economy begins to suffer and weaken a little bit, and your interest rates are at the level they are right now, it's just going to make it tough. We were talking with your producer earlier about borrowing money to be able to get a car. You know, I got one, my interest rate was 1.75%. We're looking at 6 or 7% now on the same automobile, mm-hmm. not to mention the price of the vehicle itself. So all of that plays into factors. So I think that communities like Fargo, communities like, I mean, again, similar size communities, South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, elsewhere, if you will, have the risk potentially of not being able to make the bills if the interest rates don't hold back.
So, you know, you look at that as a whole. Will it take, no different than the housing in 2008? Because as obviously, folks, you're understanding, there's one heck of a conversation going on here on the breaks. I compared 2008 to the late 1980s for agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Farmers were told, your land's worth this much money. Yeah. It was inflated. It was mm-hmm. inflated by the government. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the farmer's fault.
Nope.
It wasn't. And so then tough times came on the farm. The next thing you know, the government is taking away their land, and now you got to fight.
Exactly.
I mean, you got to fight at every auction. You got somebody who, you know, farm suicides were up, everything that goes with that. Then flash forward to 2008,
mm-hmm.
where the government's saying and banks are saying your home is worth this amount.
Exactly.
And you've got a variable rate. And the next thing you know, that rate is going up.
Exactly.
And the country's in an economic crisis. The country bails it out.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, the economy wasn't pure capitalism in 2008.
No. And you know, to a certain extent, I can see the role of government coming in and starting to say, okay, our goal is to keep a stable economy going, and therefore certain markets do need to be protected at a certain time for certain reasons. And we did that in the housing bubble, okay? When people were allowed to borrow money more than they should have, banks were making these packaged loans, as you know, they were bundling them together on loans because they were able to sell them from one bank to another bank, and therefore one didn't care what another one did with that loan. You packaged them together. These were not qualified. These were not stressed. These were loans that were highly stressed, if you will. And businesses right now are going to start facing the same thing. A recent article I talked about, I can't remember the exact percentage, about the number of business vacancies that are located in larger cities, again, like New York and other places. Those could also come back to hurt us down here as
well. What do you mean vacancies?
We're talking about businesses that built.
Storefronts?
Exactly.
Okay.
Storefronts as well as high-rises that were built for businesses that now are starting to find problems because they can't get enough workers, or they're starting to
Or they're working from home.
Yeah. And therefore, you now have vacancies over there, but those payments still have to be made.
Right.
Yeah.
I spoke to somebody near and dear to me, and he talked about the economics of what we're just talking about, which is that margin, how close that margin is on
exactly.
some of these projects. And when you look at it, I think what he's getting at is there's nothing economically we should fear more, because either we're going to have to put money in and bail it out, or they're going to go broke.
Exactly.
And some of these people that are going to go broke are very powerful politically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically their ace in the hole.
Yeah. And the reason we were able to bail out the banks, because the banks were very powerful. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it affected your and my savings. Okay. So Congress stepped in. This has happened decade after decade, like you said before. It happened in the agriculture industry. It's happened in the housing industry. We are now going to start seeing potentially it happening in the commercial area as well.
When you're in your classroom and you turn and you look at your students, do you ever talk about hypocrisy in the economy? And I'm going to give you an example of what I'm getting at. I've got a state senator back home that was beating up the administration for giving debt forgiveness to student loans. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, like you said earlier, I paid my loan, you paid your loan. You know, maybe they're right in terms of just a fairness issue. And yet that same legislator took $13,000 in PPP money,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so totally hypocrisy. He got more than what a lot of students got in debt forgiveness. For him, that was okay.
Yep.
You know, ethics wise, he was okay with that. Maybe cross your fingers, hope that nobody finds out or checks into it. Name Joel Heitkamp. I think it actually was over $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I'm getting at, do you ever look at your students and use examples like that of how economically there isn't any fairness when it comes to some of these issues?
Well, I ask my students all the time, how many of you are on welfare? Almost nobody raises their hand up. I said, do you know what the definition of welfare is? You're paying for a product that is below market value. I said, the reason you are in this institution, and I'm talking about my prior institution before Concordia, if you will, at NDSU, I tell my students that, okay, the reason you were able to go to this institution and pay the price that you're doing is because a lot of people in North Dakota are paying for you to have an education at this fine institution here today.
It's subsidized.
It's subsidized, okay? When you go to McDonald's or any of the other fast food restaurants and you have a burger, if you will, the meat is subsidized, the lettuce is subsidized, the bread is subsidized, okay? So when we start looking at welfare programs, about food stamps or housing subsidy, if you will, it's just another subsidy. So I think what we don't understand is it's easy to look at someone else and say, that's wrong, that's not fair. But when we started looking at all the things that we get as a benefit, then we start to realize our economy sustains itself by the fact that most of us are subsidized in one form or another.
So where are we going to be? And how big of a factor does debt? As a government, has our debt gotten so out of control that it's unmanageable?
I don't think it's unmanageable. I think what is unmanageable is the fact that we tend to have these conversations backwards. Okay, we put together a budget, we spend the money, we agree to do all of this other stuff without being absolutely certain we can gain at least majority of it in terms of taxes, if you will. And then we're having the conversation about whether or not we should pay for it. I think that's problematic. That is what's causing this huge issue right now with the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling should never be a conversation, Joel. We should be talking about having a budget. I mean, you know, it's fine to have a strong military. Who wouldn't want to have a strong? And we have one of the best military in the world. But we need to also take into account of the fact, do we need to spend as much as we're spending there? I'm not saying it's right or wrong. That's for professionals to decide, okay? We have a concern over the environment. We're spending all this money. Okay, that's fine. But at the same time, we keep having conversations about tax cuts or not increasing taxes. You can't have it both ways. Something is going to have to give, and the American economy needs to understand that we can only grow so fast in the limited time that we have. We have a strong belief that we have an economy that is so robust, which it is to a certain extent, that no matter how much we want to spend on anything, somehow we'll be able to find the revenue for it. At some point, China and the rest of the world is going to look at us and say, guys, we're not going to loan you the money anymore. Then where are we going to, then what are we going to do?
So how frustrating is it when people compare a balanced budget to the nation's debt? Because my point in asking that question is we can talk about a balanced budget all we want, and we should. The nation's budget mm-hmm, should be balanced.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's how government is supposed to work. But the balancing of that budget
mm-hmm.
simply pays the debt. It right. doesn't reduce the debt.
Right. And that's because we consistently plan budgets based upon what our constituents need rather than how much revenue we're bringing in. That's how Congress has always put together a budget. My district needs this, or we need that for the planet, or we need this for the military, or whatever. Okay, that's all great. But where's the money coming from all of this?
How many people do you think cheat on their taxes?
Oh, I don't know. But you know
what? No, but my point in raising that isn't like, okay, I think 20%, I think 30%. My point in saying that is to lead into this question. The only thing that stops people is fear and audit.
Absolutely.
And if you're going to take away the individuals from the IRS from having the ability to do their job, then people like Abby with a 1099 or whatever, you know, the W-2, this is what you got paid. This is the percentage the government takes. Get out of here. You know, you have no deductibles. You have nothing like that. Whereas, you know, somebody with a business, you can hide all types of income in ways.
Which is precisely why business lobbied Congress to reduce the amount of money that the IRS was given. By $1.4 billion was removed from the budget, so the IRS couldn't do their job as effectively as they could auditing businesses.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was done by Leader McCarthy. I mean, well, it was.
Exactly.
And there's no doubt that that's a separator when it comes to political philosophy, that there's a recognition that people at a lower scale pay their taxes in a more fair way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Exactly. That's why it didn't make any sense to me as why are we talking about the IRS? Aren't they the police officers, if you will, to make sure that you and I pay our fair amount and we're going to cut their budget? At the same time, we are saying we're not getting adequate revenue from those who are supposed to pay fairly. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, and you don't have anything to worry about if you just follow the law.
Exactly.
Pay the rules. So, all right, stick around. We're going to have a little bit. I get them for just a little bit more time as we talk about the economy and what just happened in the debt ceiling. I get a chance to visit a little bit longer with Riaz Aziz. He is an instructor of economics at Concordia College. There's like this big, to me, cloud waiting on the horizon. And I don't think the concept, the theory of the program itself is the problem. I think the problem is how it's treated, and that is Social Security and Medicare. How do we make sure that that is solvent, that that continues, that that works?
Once again, if you don't have workers paying into the system, that's one of the factors, if you will. Social Security was meant to be self-fulfilling. In other words, you and I pay into it so that our grandchildren and great-grandchildren, would, as they come up the line, if you will, and so forth. I have a joke I tell my students in class. I said, do you all know why I want you to graduate? And here's the reason why. When I retire and I start collecting Social Security, within 40 months, Joel, I would have taken out of Social Security every dime I've ever put it into Social Security within 40 months. Okay? That's a little over 3 years. Everything else I'm taking out of Social Security, I'm taking out of money that the employees currently
that
in the system.
That my students are paying it.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a joke, but it's also reality. So I tell them that, hey, you guys graduate, work, pay into the system because I intend to live till I'm 95 or 100.
Yep.
And therefore, I want to be getting your Social Security because the system allows me to have access to funds that I haven't actually paid into it.
What about the whole concept of, hey, if we have affordable health care, we save money for all. And I'm going to give you an example of my bias, obviously from my political side of the aisle, that there's a perception that spending goes up and that, you know, that revenue can't meet it, that the Democrats are spend crazy. Time hasn't proven that. The Clinton administration, if you look at where we're at in terms of the budget, the Obama administration, and you take off that first year of the housing crisis, and now the you know, when you look at the Trump administration versus the Biden administration, there's no comparison on which ran a tighter budget. And yet, because of that, because of the perception versus reality, it plays into how people vote.
Absolutely. And politics is a game of perception, okay? We vote for people based upon whether we like them or not, whether they are saying the same things that we want to hear from them. Take healthcare, we talked about it earlier. Okay. It's been proven time and time again. Every dime that can be spent to keeping you and me healthy adds to the productivity of the economy. I don't care how old you are, I don't care how young you are, but if we can keep you and me healthy, and I say you and me, I'm talking about the general population, mm-hmm. obviously.
Not in a hospital bed,
not in a nursing home. Productivity of this nation goes up. Incomes go up. investments go up, the return on the investments tend to go up. Okay, so this conversation about whether or not we should have healthcare for everybody else or not is really, it's like trying to figure out whether or not you should shoot your foot or you should shoot your hand. Okay, it doesn't make any sense, because at the end of the day, a healthy workforce and contributes to a healthy economy. And in return, it secures Social Security, we're talking about earlier, mm-hmm. if you will. We can get away from this conversation about the debt ceiling, because, again, more people work, more contribution to the economy, if you will, through taxes. And we don't have to have this conversation about the debt ceiling.
I have 30 seconds left. When you look at other countries' plans when it comes to healthcare, for example, do economists look at that and just laugh? And say, why don't we get it when they already have a model that shows it works?
Absolutely. And, you know, and the thing is, not every model is absolutely perfect. But if you talk to those countries that do have a healthcare system that takes care of a citizenry, they will tell you that that adds to the productivity of the economy. That adds to the longevity of the social fabric of the society. And that's because a healthy society has equals and healthy economy. There's no two ways about it.
Thanks, Raz. I always love getting a chance. Love to be in that classroom in Concordia. I appreciate it.